This is Ask a Biologist, a program about the living world, and I'm Dr. Biology. What's black and white and furry all over? Need a hint? How about if I told you they're living, they eat bamboo, and you find them in China? I bet you know the answer now. Today's program, we get to talk about the giant panda. These animals are one of the most well-known and loved animals in the world. Whenever these furry creatures come to visit a local zoo, lines of people gather, and, well, there's a bit of pandemonium. Our guests today have come to know giant pandas up close and personal. In fact, they've both had the chance to hold young panda cubs in their laps, something very few people get to do. Andrew Smith is a professor in the School of Life Sciences at ASU. We had a chance to talk to him about his main study animal, another furry creature called the pika, found on the Tibetan Plateau. Wei Fu Wen is a faculty member in the Institute of Zoology, Chinese Academy of Sciences. He's been studying the giant panda for more than 20 years and is considered a world expert on the evolutionary ecology of the giant panda in the wild. He's one of the scientists who published a paper in the journal Current Biology that asked the question, are giant pandas heading for extinction? I think you'll be pleasantly surprised and pleased the answer that Dr. Wei and his colleagues have found. Welcome to the show, Dr. Smith, and a special thank you to Dr. Wei for sitting down and talking with us while visiting Arizona State University. This is a long way from China.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Dr. Wei.
It's my honor to be here to talk with you guys.
Before we get into all the research that Dr. Wei has been doing, I thought we'd talk a little bit about the giant panda. A lot of people know what they look like, but let's go through a few details. How giant is a giant panda? In other words, how big are they?
Oh, giant pandas are very, very big. As you know, it's compared with other species, like the red panda. It's quite big. It's about 1.5 meters long and 1.8 meters high. It weighs about 100 kilograms.
100 kilograms.
Yeah.
So they're about, what, 30 inches tall at the, about the shoulder? Mm-hmm. And they're about, well, they're over 200 pounds.
Yeah, I have no idea about the pounds, but it's,
I think
might
it's 2.2,
like that.
So that would make 220 pounds
right.
would be the conversion.
Very good.
The male is a little bit bigger than the female.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they're big. Are they strong?
I think so. It's very strong and wild. In the captivity, we said the pen is very, very tender, but don't go quite close to him. Yeah, it's... might be very dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah. You actually have a story about being in the wild and observing.
Yes, in the wild, it's very hard to get close.
You actually have some recordings of pandas, don't you?
Sure. Yes.
Well, maybe later in the show we can play some of those recordings and talk just a little bit about them.
One thing I can say, I mean, although pandas are very big and weigh a lot, they actually look even bigger. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first saw pandas at the Wulong Giant Panda Breeding Center, there was a one-year-old panda up in the tree, and it was looking like it didn't belong in the tree, like it would fall, and it kept looking like it would fall, and it was very awkward, and I whispered under my breath, what happens if they fall? And the director of the breeding center said, they bounce. And then he let me hold the panda in my lap, and the fur was so thick. Mm-hmm. That it was just, I could see that maybe the panda would bounce.
Uh-huh. But the baby is very, very small.
Yeah.
It's a newborn baby. It's just 100 grams. That's quite small.
I have a picture of you with you holding one of the baby cubs. They are called cubs, I assume.
Sure. Yeah. You know? It's a baby or cubs. That's correct.
And pandas are bears, right?
Yes. They're the most primitive of the 8 bear species in the world. And so actually biochemically, they're even very different because they split off and are the most primitive bear, and then all the other bears are more similar to each other, and the panda is the most unlike all of the other true bears in the world.
I actually went up to one of my favorite sources, which is Wikipedia, and looked into it, and I said, oh, they are actually bears.
Yeah, it takes a long time to get this down, to be the panda is a bear. In the past, the panda can be the another family, not a bear family, it's the own family. Might be a family of the red panda. Yeah, they come together, but finally, from a genetic study, people think it's real bear.
Right. Yeah. It took the genetics to actually get the real truth.
Yeah.
All right. Well, when we look at the pandas in the wild, and you had a wonderful lecture. I enjoyed it yesterday. I got to see a lot of pandas in forests, bamboo forests. Mm-hmm. The forests are very green. Pandas are black and white. What's up with that? I mean, it doesn't seem normal. Most animals seem to blend into their surroundings. Why is a panda black and white?
We have a joking about that. Panda never have the color picture because it's white and black. It's hard to say about why the panda have this kind of a color. There are some prediction about that. It might relate to the visual communication because some people thinking that the giant panda is short-sighted. With this kind of the color, the giant panda can see each other very far distance. So not get two panda quite close. If they get very close, they were fighting for the home range or for the...
I see. So in this case, it's so that they can see very easily from a distance that there's another panda out there. Mm-hmm. And they don't really have predators, do they?
There is the predators, such as the leopard, common leopard. Right. Another one is a yellow-throated marten. It's the predator is just have harmful for the cubs, not for the adults.
Right, so once you get to become an adult, you have less to worry about. So if you're black and white, who cares, right?
Yeah.
But the cubs do, yes. Yeah. That I do recall from your lecture, you mentioned that as well. The other thing, you talked about their vision. You said they're short-sighted. And they're also curious because most bears, the pupil of the eyes are round. And pandas actually have eyes like a cat. And again, learning a little bit with my research, the name for panda in China is bear cat, correct?
Yes. We call that the da xiong mao. Da means big. Xiong means bear. Mao means cat. So to put them together, the big bear cat.
Well, I think it's really nice and descriptive because it just talks about what the eyes look like and, of course, then they are bear. Pandas live in the forest, bamboo forest, which is very convenient because that's what they eat. That's their main diet, right? Bamboo?
Yeah. Yes.
But bamboo are extremely interesting plants in that they grow for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah.
And then they flower. And for any species of bamboo, when they flower, they die after they flower. And what's interesting is if you have a species of bamboo that's in a pot in Buenos Aires, in Sydney, Australia, in Phoenix, Arizona, they will all flower and die at the same time. That they're synchronous worldwide, regardless of whether they're being grown in captivity or not.
Oh, really?
And it's one of the really unique things about bamboo. So any species of bamboo is synchronous worldwide.
That's fascinating.
See,
we're learning. We learn all the time.
Yeah.
Well, so they eat bamboo, so then I would say they would be an herbivore, but they actually do eat other things besides plants, right, sometimes?
Yeah. They're sampling some of the plants. It's quite rare.
Uh-huh.
Also, sometimes you can find some meat as bones in his droppings.
Oh, in the droppings.
Yeah.
Now you're talking about panda droppings. And this takes us actually into your research. Turns out that you published a paper, was it in 2006?
Yeah.
2006. It was a very interesting paper because it reset the total number of pandas in the world to a higher number because the census that had been done before wasn't really accurate. You went out and tried to get an idea of how many pandas you'd see and then estimate from there how many more there might be. Your research is a little different. Can you talk about how you figured out how many pandas are living in the wild?
Okay. You know, Chinese government has paid much more attention to about a giant panda conservation. In the history, we have done 3 national surveys to try to estimate how many giant panda in the wild. The first estimation is in the 1970s. It's over 2,500, something like that. Second survey has been conducted in 1980s. The estimation number is over 1,000. The third national survey has come to the number of the 1,500 to 1,600, something like that. But some people, it's hard to estimate the giant panda, even for the people, human population. It's hard to get the accurate numbers of the human population.
Right.
So some people doubt about the number because they just use the dropping to estimate the population size of giant pandas in the wild. So how to accurate to estimate the panda population? We developed a new methodology using panda droppings. We try to extract the DNA from panda droppings because it contains the cell of a giant panda. We can do that. So we extract the DNA and amplify the microsatellite, it's kind of the genetic marker to genotype. If the droppings share the same genotype, we think they came from the same individual. If it's different, they're different individuals. So use this kind of methodology, you can accurately estimate the population.
All right, so with the panda droppings, you're able to extract the DNA and you're able to isolate it to individual pandas. So that, say, you have a dozen panda droppings. Mm-hmm. You could go through all those, and it could turn out that it was all from one panda.
Yeah, might be.
Right. Yeah. While as you could have a dozen panda droppings, and it's 12 individual pandas. Mm-hmm. So it's much more accurate figuring out how many pandas are out there.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the other things, naturally, about panda droppings is that because they eat bamboo is largely filled with silicon, which can't be digested, is that the bamboo must go through the panda very fast because they get very little nutrition from eating the bamboo. So they eat the bamboo, and the forest is covered with droppings because they have to have frequently defecate their droppings to make room to eat more bamboo. If they don't have this going through them really fast and eating lots and lots of bamboo, mm-hmm. they won't get enough energy to grow and to survive.
How big is a dropping?
So this size.
Okay, so about 6 inches long by about, 3 or 4 inches in diameter.
Like a child's football size.
Yeah, and it looks like it's really woven fibers, of course. It's pretty dense. When you go out looking for these, how many droppings did you have to collect?
We collect a lot of samples. There are abundant of this droppings in the wild. You couldn't get all of there. You have tried to find, is this from the guest? Is this from the same panels or not? After that, you connected some of them. Uh-huh. We have done a pilot study in Wangdong Natural Reserve. Finally, we get over 300 droppings back to the laboratory. We genotype this kind of the droppings. We found over 300 droppings come from 66 pandas.
Okay, yeah. So 300 droppings, and you ended up with 66 individuals.
Yeah.
Well, they're pretty active, aren't they?
That's right.
The habitat for the giant panda, this is another thing that we would be very interested in, because without the bamboo and without the forest that they live in, that's obviously going to be a problem.
Yeah.
How is the habitat doing in China right now for the giant panda?
It's doing very well. The government has put a lot of money and effort to try to protect the wild habitat of the giant pandas. Yeah. compared with the second national survey, its habitat has been improved a lot. The potential habitat has been increased about 50%. So there are huge habitat for them. Yeah.
This is one of the things we've been worrying about is the extinction of the giant panda.
Everybody is worried about that.
Right. You have a little more optimistic view that maybe it's not the end of the line for the panda. Is that correct?
I think so, yeah.
What do we need to do to make sure it's not the end of the line for the panda? What do we need to keep doing?
Yeah, we have to keep doing is to protect their habitat. That's very important. No habitat, no pandas, no animals, just a human being, yeah. So the first things we need to do, they still keep protect the habitat. I think the things we need to pay more attention to the most isolated population, because in that population, the giant panda's number is very low. They might go to extinction in the future. So we need to do some translocation or reintroduction in the future. Yeah.
Right. You showed a map, and were there seven habitats or seven ranges, different individual ranges for the panda?
Six. Yeah.
There are six of them. Okay. And they're separated, which is part of the problem, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there anything underway to bridge the gaps between those ranges to help expand the diversity of the pandas?
To put in corridors between the different protected areas so that pandas can move from one place to the other to increase their diversity.
Yeah.
And that's a major conservation goal for pandas as well as for many other large mammals.
Yeah, that's one of the strategies the government was thinking about. Yeah, but if you put the corridor there, it will spend a lot of money and...
It's very difficult, and
yeah,
you end up dealing a lot with what in the field of conservation biology is called community-based conservation. You can have a scientific principle, and you can realize that you have fragmentation, which is the word in conservation for having these little patches of habitat with animal populations that are divided. They're fragmented, and to bring the fragments together, you want to build corridors, but the corridors is where people live. And so much work in conservation biology is dealing with community-based conservation. Even within a protected area, the protected areas in China are different than, say, national parks in the United States because people live in the protected areas. Often the agriculture will follow a river valley, and if the people get to be too many and their fields become broader across the river valley than even the north and south half of a protected area, may be divided in half. So there's the need to have corridors and to work with local people. A lot of the conservation work in China that's being done by the Chinese government and various non-government organizations is to work through these aspects of working with local people. Because
right.
If local people aren't engaged in saving
yeah.
a species, then all the scientists and all the government can't do anything.
Yeah.
You have to
Andrew
have everybody engaged.
Andrew has very good comments for that. Another kind of strategy to build the corridors between the isolated population. Yeah.
The other thing that the Chinese government has been doing for quite a while, and they've become much more successful, is actually raising pandas in captivity.
Yeah.
And this is an interesting and sometimes used method in wildlife conservation, and it has its own critics, I would have to say. What I was curious about is if you raise a panda, especially when I see these cute pandas on laps of people, do you have a problem or can you even reintroduce them into the wild? Is that something you can do?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a future strategy to, if you have much more giant pandas over there, you have to do the reintroduction, release them to the wild. Yeah, that's kind of the called ex situ conservation program. Yeah.
And have they actually been reintroducing pandas into the wild?
Yes, there's two reintroduction program has been done during the past 2 years. One panda, it's called Sydney Number 1, was released to the wild. that panda is from the wild. That's kind of a translocation. Mm-hmm. So just put them to another place.
Right.
That panda is successfully lived in the wild.
Okay.
Another program is done by Wolong Natural Reserve. They put the captive born pandas in the wild with an enclosure and let them stay there for 2 years. After that, release them to the wild. However, that panda was killed by other pandas.
Okay.
So it's not so successful, but it provides us a lot of experience for future reintroduction program.
Yeah. Right. Andrew, do you have a view on that?
A lot of money has gone into doing the captive breeding. And like I say, I think the international world is actually expecting more and more of these reintroductions to take place. But as we've just learned, it's very difficult to do this. Animals have their natural territories, and not only are the animals somewhat inexperienced, but they're smaller. And the big dominant male pandas may have a larger territory or home range and may be protecting that. So I think ultimately a lot of the captive bred pandas may have to go into areas where there aren't other pandas. So that we can populate areas where there are fewer pandas, and that might be a more successful strategy.
Oh, I see. That makes a lot of sense. Don't put them in with the ones that are so successful, the wild pandas that are the tough guys out there. Put them in with a larger room to
roam. No density area.
Right.
Or some area where there's no pandas.
Right.
But in the past, there was pandas.
Oh, that's a neat. I like that. Oh, we'll be listening and reading and hoping we hear more about that in the future. There's the picture of Dr. Wei, and he has this really cute, and I have to say, cute panda in his lap. What's it like holding a panda? Is it like holding a normal household pet, or is there? Can you describe it?
When you hold a panda, it's very soft. It will be very exciting about that. Yeah, that's a picture taken in Wolong. It says 2 months.
2 month old?
Yeah, 2 month old.
And do they spend a lot of time focusing on you? Do they actually look into your eyes?
When I was holding the panda Wolong, I think it was a 4 month old maybe.
Yeah.
My impression was that, again, the fur was just so thick. It was just amazing. I mean, I've never imagined fur could be that thick. And then the scientist who knew that particular panda said that it was teething, and to put my hand in its mouth. And so I put my hand in the mouth, and it sort of just gently chewed on me because it was just its teeth were just coming in, just teething, and it was sort of tickled a little bit. It was just a thrill to be able to hold an animal that you never thought that you would ever have in your lap. But it was very different than other animals that I've held because it was very gentle and very calm. Certainly when they grow up, they can become much more dangerous. But the young ones that we were able to hold,
very cute.
It's really, they're adorable.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, we're not going to be running out into the wilds of China trying to hold an adult male panda in our lap.
Probably spend years and years looking to even find one for the first time.
Yeah.
We can ask Fuan how long he worked on pandas in the wild before he ever saw his very first panda.
That's about 15 years.
15 years?
Yeah, in the wild. It's very, very hot. In Sichuan, the mountain is very high and it's very deep. Also, the panda density is not too high. So it's very hard for you to find the real pandas over there. What we can find is a feeding sign, droppings. That's very easy.
Well, that's amazing to me because, again, we just talked about the fact that they're black and white, and you'd think you'd be able to see a lot of them and everywhere, but there's so few of them. You know, what's the range for them? How many pandas would I find on a couple square kilometers?
It's 5 square kilometers.
5 to 8. Okay.
Yeah.
Five square.
And they'll be slightly overlapping.
Yeah.
And males and females will overlap. And
Dr. Wei, you also have some recordings of pandas in the wild, don't you?
We have some of them.
Right. Yeah. Well, I want to listen to a couple of them right now.
Okay. Panda have the lots of the different kinds of the sounds they can make. Different sounds have different meaning. There might be over 15 different kinds of sounds.
So the pandas have about 15 different calls.
Yeah, over 15 right. different
what calls. Did we just listen to? Which were the two calls?
The barking, like the dog, the barking, also have the chirp. Different kind. I kind of remember all of the name. Yeah, so,
What is the chirp used for?
It's for the mating.
For mating?
Yeah, for mating.
And
yeah.
The barking?
Barking, it's during the mate, before mating.
Before mating.
Fighting or something like that.
Fighting for something like that, okay. Well, Andrew, you've been really good because you've been on the show before and you've answered these three questions that I'm going to ask Dr. Wei. I always ask three questions of my guests. The first question is, when did you first know you wanted to be a scientist or a biologist?
Ah, that's hard to answer, huh? When I was 16 years, I took entrance examination to the college. At the first, I don't want to study the biology. I would like to study the medicine or something, be a doctor, because my father was very, very ill before I went to the college. But I finally failed to go to the medical school. I was enrolled in during the teacher's college. You will be a teacher for future. During the 4-year study, I'm thinking I should be to be some scientist or something like that. So I took my master degree in the teacher's college. Then I went to my PhD to be a scientist.
So you had an evolution of your own, didn't you?
Sure. You have to make a good choice.
The other question I like to ask is, if I took that away from you, you weren't going to be a biologist, you're not going to be a scientist, and you had the ability to do some other kind of career, what would you do?
I have no idea about that. might be a teacher in high school to train more students or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the last question I ask is, what advice do you have for people that want to become biologists or scientists?
To be a good scientist, you have to work very hard. That's the first thing you need to do, especially for the biologist and field biologist. Every day you stay in the mountain area. That's very tough. You get a lot of rain every day. You go to the field. You climb the mountain. Cost you a lot of energy over there. That's it. First thing is you have to work very hard to get the data, what you want. Another one, you have to be very clever to think about a scientific question. Yeah, what kind of scientific question you ask? You try to answer this kind of question. Yeah, that's very important.
Actually, you need to do some exercise and be strong for one thing if you're going to be out there walking around the mountains.
Yeah.
And the other one is to make sure that you can be prepared to do the actual research itself, know how to ask the questions, and if you ask the questions, how to find the answers.
Yeah.
Well, this is very good advice. Andrew Smith, Wei Fu Wen, I really appreciate you sitting down with us today. I know that I have learned a lot about the giant panda today, and have a new respect and hope for their survival.
Great to be back.
Dr. Wei.
Thanks. My honor.
You've been listening to Ask a Biologist, and my guests have been Professor Andrew Smith from the ASU School of Life Sciences and Dr. Wei Fu Wen, a faculty member in the Institute of Zoology, Chinese Academy of Sciences. The Ask a Biologist podcast is produced on the campus of Arizona State University, and even though our program is not broadcast live, you can still send us your questions about biology using our companion website. The address is askabiologist.asu.edu. Or you can just Google the words, Ask a Biologist. I'm Dr. Biology.